What's going on, everybody? Welcome to Whiskey, Web, and Whatnot with myself, Robbie the Wagner, and Charles William Carpenter III. He didn't say anything.
I'm changing it to Robbie the Wagner III.
Okay, you can do that.
Yeah.
It's not taken anywhere.
I don't know if it's the second. No. It's a free handle up for anyone's.
And we have a special guest today, Sarah Drasner. How's it going, Sarah?
Hi, everyone. It's good to be here. I'm really excited to be here. I've seen y'all at Render ATL, and that was a fun time. So thanks.
Nice. Yeah. I'm glad you remember. There was so much whiskey being poured there that, it's all a little hazy to me, at least.
Truly, yes.
Yeah. And you got one of the bottles of Sagamore, right?
I didn't, because I had to go on a plane. But I did in spirit, literally spirit.
Yeah. Yeah. Literally and figuratively.
So if there's anyone that has not heard of you, do you want to give a brief intro into who you are and what you do?
Sure. I've been a developer for a long time, over 20 years. I started my career as more of an IC and dark matter developer in the sense of like not really participating in open source at that time. And then I eventually decided that I wanted to, since I was using so many tools, that I wanted to be more involved in open source. So I started doing a lot of open source contributions, writing articles, making GitHub repos and developer tooling, and then eventually got really involved in React and keynoted a bunch of their conferences. And then I discovered Vue and got very enamored with Vue and became a Vue core team member and was a Vue core team member for several years. I also kind of at work go between managerial and IC pendulum. So like at Microsoft, I was a principal IC specializing in serverless functions for Azure. Then more recently, I was a VP at a company called Netlify, which is a startup, but it's a startup that's pretty widely used in open source. I got to work with lovely people while I was there. And I left that job to start my own company because I had gotten to know some of the investors of Netlify. However, then I was approached by Google and they asked me if I wanted to run web infrastructure for Google. And that was a very exciting opportunity. And I deliberated and I decided to take it. And more recently, my role has expanded. So before I was running web infrastructure at Google, and now I run web, Android, iOS, and multi-platform infrastructure at Google.
That's quite a mouthful.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And I don't do open source work anymore.
Turns out all of those responsibilities require a little more from you.
Yeah, it sounds like the only framework you haven't been intimately involved in is Ember, which makes me a little sad. But
yeah, I guess I didn't mention that. Like in my job, I run a bunch of frameworks. You know, I'm not individually running them. I'm more like the grandma, the director. But Angular is one of those frameworks. So I've been involved in React, Vue, and now Angular.
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there and things we will discuss in a bit. But let's jump into the whiskey before we get too deep into that. What do we got today, Chuck?
Well, let's see here. Today we're having I love that.
Mine's still in the box.
Today, yes. Oh, you're way behind.
I just had a meeting, sorry.
Your label. All right. You better get to your label while I introduce it. It's the Bren, I guess I'm saying that right. Yeah, because it's supposed to be French.
Well, French, French single malt whiskey. Do like the last Bren. Four letters. You just get rid of those.
Bren. Bre. Bre. So we'll say for the Yank and me, Bren. French single malt whiskey. It's not age stated, but it is 100% malt whiskey in its mash bill. Although I think I read, maybe I didn't put this down here, but it's a blend of two different strains of malt barley. And let's see here. It is initially aged in French Limousin oak and then finished in cognac casks. I know that it's distilled at an old French cognac distillery. So that's a big part of like, they decided to, so the founder, I actually met her once in New York City at like 2016 or something. Anyway, she wanted to try the cognac process, but with a malt whiskey. And so it's like kind of a blend of that process and those old ideologies applied to a more modern whiskey. It is 100% organic and non-GMO, although I think the European thing kind of enforced that. It is only 80 proof, so it's a little lighter for my taste typically, but seems like something very interesting. And I always make this like the price point to me also is a differentiator and sort of like how much value I'm getting and how I feel about it. Like, oh, it's really expensive, but it tastes very mediocre. Then I kind of penalize for that. So it's about $60 a bottle.
Nice. It smells good.
Yeah. Popping that top, I already.
It smells like a tropical and grape candy to me.
Ooh. Hmm. So you say tropical, that makes me think of coconut.
It's no, like a pineapple sweet. Or mango.
Hmm.
Yeah, who said coconut? It does taste.
I say coconut.
Yeah.
I get a little of that. Little floral, little coconut, at least in the smell. Yeah.
It actually tastes like coconut a little.
Yeah.
I was not expecting
really
that.
It's really smooth.
Hmm.
You can kind of get the cognac flavor in there, too.
Yeah. So since it's finished in cognac barrels, it's definitely going to get a hint of that. So, I have kind of a... Even like a light champagne flavor to me. Yeah, I'd say for 80 proof, this packs a lot of flavor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's very light.
Yeah, I shouldn't hold it in front of my face. It makes me very blurry.
This is the only thing that matters.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Doesn't really help. There's a certain... You know, we're still getting better at this use a fancy camera for your webcam thing. Fixed lenses, all that fun stuff. I just want to be like the cool people on the internet.
It's got a little bit of like earthiness or something on the finish too.
Yeah, but no burn whatsoever for me, which is, I kind of miss that. I want a little of that. I want to know I'm having alcohol in that juice.
It does have like it kind of goes almost into a burn and then it cuts right at the end.
Yeah, like right before it gets there in your throat. It's like, it's a little bit stingy in the mouth and then, but good. I do enjoy this so far. Yeah, it's very
I would
unique.
Buy this again for sure.
So given having tasted it, first of all, one litmus test for you, maybe Sarah, is... So she was mentioning before we got started that she kind of had to hide this bottle just to make sure her husband didn't get to it and then finish it. Do you think he would have enjoyed it?
Oh, yeah. I'll enjoy the rest of the bottle with him tonight. I just made slow cooker chili and we're going to have some of it later. Ooh. But if I had left this out, it would have been gone by the time the podcast had been. So I hid it. And I hid it in a safe space, but then I forgot where this safe space was. It was just like,
yeah. So
I have a habit of doing this. Like, there was one point where I wanted to keep my passport safe and I couldn't find it. And I ripped apart my room. I had put it inside a travel book.
Which, in like looking back on it, seems like maybe a logical place. That was a travel book you were looking at the time or something.
I thought I was being clever. It's not. I was so mad at myself.
Too clever for yourself. And side note, to be fair to your husband, we did send this to you a little while ago. So it's got to be like a couple months or at least over a month.
Yeah, it would have been gone.
Yeah. In fact, I'm going to finish this tonight myself before I leave the office, possibly. Mm. We'll see.
That's good for driving home. Yeah,
it is. Yeah. I've got a robot car. Figure it out. Mm. Anyway, let's regress a little bit back to the point. So we have... a highly complex scale, 0 to 8 tentacles. So 0 being the worst that you've ever had. Don't have this again. 4, obviously middle of the road, pretty good stuff, but doesn't stand out to me. 8, amazing. You can classify that or compare it against anything you want. All whiskeys, all liquors, whatever else. We started segmenting stuff just because we've had so many, but.
It's really high, actually. I think it's probably like a 7. Not many things get to 8. For me. So it's not to say that it's not amazing. I think it's actually quite good. There's only, I think, 2 whiskeys I would put at an 8.
I'd love to hear what those 2 are for you. What are the top for you?
I really love Michter's. That's just one of my all-time favorites for so many reasons. I think it's really balanced and very smooth. And like to your point about the price point, it's fairly cheap for what you get. It's really very good. I also like Craigellachie. I'm going to probably mispronounce that one. It's Scottish, I believe. It has a little bit more smokiness than the Michter's does. But that one is really smooth, but also very complex and just a little bit of smoke.
Yeah, there's very diverse choices there too. So that's interesting. You're like equal opportunities.
Yes. What about y'all?
Well, in terms of this whiskey, this one for me is pretty good. It's not really what I would reach for in a flavor profile day to day. But I think for what it is very good. They've executed what they tried to do very well. So with that in mind, just because it's not my favorite, I'm going to give it a 6, but I think there's not really anything bad about it necessarily. My favorites are like really spicy rye, so it's a little different for me.
Like what?
The Sagamore, like the barrel pick we did, is one of my top ones. Peerless is pretty good. Everything
you like
Whistle
the Willet,
Pig,
don't you?
Yeah, the Willet's okay. I think the Willet is a little overrated, honestly. Like it has a lot of name recognition, but
hot take starts early.
Well, I'm not, again, it's not bad. I would not be like, oh no, you brought me Willet, let me throw it in the trash. But I would, at its price point, I wouldn't seek it out a ton, I think, because it's expensive and hard to find.
Right. I think the Sagamore Rye, which you can find for like $35-$40, mm-hmm. is pretty darn good, given that too, and way more accessible. If I could pick it up at a CVS, then it's actually kind of says something, I guess.
Points for being something that you could drink every day, because like Angel's Envy is a favorite of mine, but it's not a favorite of mine because it's so complex and interesting. It's a favorite of mine because it's a crowd pleaser. Like if I have a lot of people over, sure. I know I can bring out Angel's Envy and everybody will pretty much like it.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's a pretty good point. I don't think it's something we've taken into consideration, but it's at least something to talk about that makes sense. Is like, people will ask you for certain recommendations and you usually would tell them things that, you know, A, they can probably find, and B, that like is approachable to a larger group of people. And so yeah, that's a pretty good point. I would say this applies in that way. If anybody's going for malt whiskey and expecting a scotch-like experience, this is probably not going to work for them. It's not going to hit. If people are coming new into whiskey, this would be like a pretty nice one that is approachable. It's like very drinkable. It's kind of like, what is that? Basil Hayden's is another like very low proof bourbon that a lot of people kind of like, yeah, this is easy. So I would say in that realm of things, but this is like so different than most malt whiskeys that you're going to have. So it's hard for me to like put it in a Scotch or Japanese whiskey kind of category. I think it's very good. I think I'm probably in the 7 as well, because it just stands out as so unique. I don't know that I'd drink it every day, but I definitely would recommend it to folks. I don't think the price is bad. I think they're doing something very cool and different. And when I think about different malt whiskeys, there's like, I don't know if we tried it on here or not, but there's the Del Bach whiskey is very interesting too, because they mesquite smoke the malt before the process. And you kind of get some of that without like I'm ingesting a campfire kind of feel. So, you know, unique in another very different way. So yeah, I think I'd give this a 7. I think anybody would be like, this tastes good. It's interesting.
Yeah. Smoke is such an interesting one because I think some people just like smoke ubiquitously. When I was in college, there was this gross kitchen where everybody like had dishes and nobody cleaned them because we were newly college students and we didn't know how to be adults yet. And someone had a bottle of liquid smoke that they didn't take care of and smashed, and the whole kitchen smelled like liquid smoke. And so now I have this really strong distinction between real smoke flavors versus artificial smoke flavors. Like artificial smoke flavors make me feel a little nauseous because I remember the dorm kitchen. And then real smoke flavors feel very full bodied and taste really good to me. I don't think I ever made that distinction before that time. Not that I drank tons of whiskey before I was 18, but
I did. But it was all bad in plastic bottles.
That's right. So. Good. I should have said good whiskeys. Yes.
Yeah. I've had a lot of sketchy drinks before I had money to pay for not sketchy drinks.
Yeah. I had a long time where I had like a real hate vomit inducing relationship with Mountain Dew, because I would use it as a chaser for either cheap vodka or Everclear with groups of friends. Like, why that was ever a good idea? Let's take this strong bad flavor and cover it up with a different kind of strong flavor
and lots of caffeine.
Became very well, I need all that sugar and caffeine to stay up till 4 a.m. continuing that cycle. So
I still can't drink orange juice for that reason.
Yeah, why has everybody experienced orange juice coming in and out? You know, I feel like everybody
brunch did
has
this
had
to
it
us
both ways. Yeah. Oh, well before brunch, but brunch, bottomless brunches weren't helpful.
No,
anyway.
Yeah, let's pivot to some tech things here.
Mm-hmm. Tech like things. So hot takes. We want to talk about some hot takes. I guess I'll just start at the top instead of cherry picking. You're welcome, Robbie.
You can do whatever you want. I don't care.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm taking that one. You just added it. Life or death moment you have to pick. Angular, Vue, or React?
Oh, that's mean because...
It's just a hot, spicy take. Yeah.
Whatever you choose, you'll be wrong. So,
no, no.
I wonder how this is going to be used against me later, because no matter how I answer, it will be.
Right.
I would say Angular because I see what the team is doing and what they're evolving toward. Like, they have survived multiple waves and now they're evolving. Some of the Signals implementation is really interesting. Some of the new, if you don't know about the revamping the reactivity system and the new Signals offering, you should check it out. Ryan Carnotto from Solid was also really crucial to consulting with the team on some of that. So that was quite interesting. And then some of the control flow pieces that they're working on. I am not saying that Angular is perfect. Do not get me wrong. There's a lot that it already holds up. I think migration tooling is pretty substantial given that it supports all these major enterprises and has figured out a way to update. Having been involved in React and Vue, there's different migration things that go on there and they're not as evolved in those areas. That said, Vue will always hold a very special place in my heart. And if you talk to the Angular team, they will tell you that I bring up Vue all the time and that a lot of things are inspired in Angular because of Vue, but also Vue was inspired by Angular. If you learn about the roots of Vue, it was initially almost not really a fork of Angular, but it borrowed a lot of concepts directives and things like that. React also has a special place in my heart though too, because React is really came at a time that was quite crucial for the industry and thought about state in a really significant way that made everybody revisit and ask questions about, do we need a whole MVC for all of this? Can we approach things with the Vue layer only? There's a lot of work that couldn't have been done in Angular, in Vue, in any framework without React as a staple. And there's a reason why it's so well used. It's a tough question. And I know I'm giving a kind of it depends answer. but I love them all for different reasons. I don't think that there's a single thing that I could do, a single, user interface that I couldn't make in each one of them. There's a lot of trade-offs for each one of them too. But the way that Angular is evolving, and especially because it is evolving towards some of the use cases for YouTube, for some of the more significant Pantheon, Google Cloud Console, some of the more significant pieces of infrastructure that Google supports, as well as external. It's pretty thoughtful. And maybe I just think that because I see the behind the scenes, but I've been really appreciative of the hard work that the team has to do in order to make that happen.
Yeah. Spoken like a true senior engineering leader. But not that I think anything you said is wrong necessarily. Absolutely. Well, of course, it depends. Is a good default answer on things.
Well,
and there's been,
you can also only build a full app in Angular if we're being picky about it, right? It's just the Vue layer for Vue and React. So that's a trick question, right? Are we including meta frameworks or other libraries to add in to build an app or not? Because if not, that answer may be different.
So it has to be Nuxt and Next versus Angular.
Yeah, can we call it Nangular now? Put an N on there.
Meta framework. I'm not sure if my position changes. I think Nuxt and Vue together are really solid combination. Nuxt, of course, is great too, but I think Nuxt takes developer experience to the next level with some of the plugin interfaces, some of the modules, some of the way that Nuxt thinks about performance, along with Vue's the revamp to the reactivity system using proxies and things coupled with the new advents in Nuxt. It's really quite smooth developer experience. It's very good. And I think the performance is good.
But I mean, kudos to Angular, the Angular team, in that they always look to be inspired to what's happening and are willing to kind of take in influences that move things forward regardless, instead of having like too strong of opinion and argue and fall on that sword. The way they integrated CLI, inspired by Ember, for example, a big one. Yeah, I did some work in like Angular 1 and 2 early on and was not very excited about that. But coming back to it at Angular 9 and just seeing the progress there and actually...
So 45 years ago is when you came back to it?
45 years ago. Exactly. Because I don't know what...
It's on version like a billion now.
Yeah, I don't know. But 9 to me was like, whoa, TypeScript is there, first class citizen, the DX is really fun. Say hi to your dog, yeah. Sarah. all of those things were like, wow, they actually really are moving forward and iterating and giving us some nice things. So, you know, kudos to that team, even 45 years ago.
I mean, so. Angular, in a sense, is kind of like a meta framework. I mean, it's not our own because it does include things like the router that, you know, it includes things like the CLI that you're talking about. It includes scaffolding. It includes a lot of the things that you reach for in a meta framework. And now that Angular is engaged with the Chrome team on things like the image component, you're probably familiar with the image component in Next. It's come to Angular 2. Some of the things that you reach for a meta framework in order to do Angular already had, kind of. So,
I mean, like Robbie said, it's basically when you're looking at, can I create an application without having to make any or very few choices on tooling along the way? Like, is it just let me spin up something? It's made some decisions. It's opinionated. And that's great because I'm buying into that because I want to ship. I don't want to think about what's my state machine. I don't want to think about which router strategy do I use and, you know, all kinds of extra crazy things like that, piecemealing things together.
And TypeScript, inferred types or explicit types?
Well, I think both in a way, because if you want to leverage inferred types, but then also declare explicit types. And what I mean by that is in languages like Kotlin, you actually have the ability to declare explicit types, but then the type inference is there as kind of a backup. And I think that's quite elegant. I guess I'm not answering the question because I'm not answering it in a TypeScript way.
You have to answer it from your own context or feelings or whatever. So there's your example. So in general, that's how you feel about it is
some of both. I like the idea of being explicit, but I also appreciate when languages are a little bit more bulletproof.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Yeah. I've encountered a lot more lately of needing to be explicit because like the types just will not match. And I'm like, just match here. You're this thing. And it's like, you're right. I'm that thing. So, like, it's better than throwing an any on it or typecasting it, just like telling the function what it returns, and then you use the function elsewhere, and you're like, it works.
Yeah, it's kind of like how I wish that somebody would just tell me the taxes I owe. It's maybe a bad
one. Oh, yeah.
But, like,
no,
it's a guessing game of, like, here's what I think I owe, and then we're like, yes, or that, no, like, just tell me what I owe and I'll pay you.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that would be too easy. And then also, how can others game the system?
Yeah. It's all fake because a lot of people never pay any tax. And then, yeah, you pick a number and pay them and they're like, oh, that's wrong. We're going to fine you or like
jail.
Threaten you to go to jail. Yeah.
Can you just tell me what? Yeah, I saw some comic like some time ago where it was like that. Hey, IRS, can you tell me what I owe? No. Can you give me an idea or how to figure that out? No. Okay, well, I'll just pay this. Okay, it's time to go to jail.
Yeah. Yeah.
The penalties for that don't match. All righty. I like this one. Get rebase or get merge?
I keep giving you it depends answers. I mean, I'm mostly using get merge, but get rebase has... I mean, there's a lot of reasons to use get rebase as well. I think it's actually more common these days. It kind of shifted. Like, I think Git merge was more widely used maybe 5 years ago, and then everybody moved to Git rebase, and now that is more ubiquitous. I would say it's probably more what the culture on your team does so that you're not confusing people. If you're like a lone merge person in a rebase world, then maybe just do the same thing as the rest of your team.
Right, right. Again, that's, I think, a very managerial-like response. But it, you know, it, it is be a good citizen depending on where you're at. I do believe in that. So,
oh, what do you, what do you all think?
I like rebates personally, but if I was in a situation full of merge folks, then assimilate.
It just kills me that merge has to have merge commits. Every other, like, even if you squash everything to one commit, you still get this nice clean commit and I merged this commit as two different commits. I just don't like that. So it's a picky thing, but that's my reasoning. And
I think that's true. I think that's why everybody moved to Rebase.
Yeah, I don't know. Something like that. Just a more visual appeal of the timeline. I don't know.
Yeah. But then again, like, you hardly ever do look at the Git history unless something goes really, really wrong. So does it matter? Maybe not.
I think folks that are more in charge of delivery, like, there were stronger opinions there at different times, because there would be times where you essentially can reset production based on going back in history and having these, like, clear lines of releases was kind of nice there. But that, I think, as delivery pipelines have changed a little bit, quite a bit actually, that, you know, that wasn't so important, and then cleanliness of the releases starts to become a little more. I don't know. That's just what I've experienced, but that's a small subset of things, I'm sure. All right, Robbie, next question is you. It was made for you.
Is it the Tailwind?
The
one?
Second bullet point.
Okay. Yeah. Tailwind or vanilla CSS?
Oh, God. I keep doing that. It depends.
Be you, though.
What do you like using more? Not what is the best tool for the job. What do you like?
I would say vanilla CSS, and maybe that makes me old. But what the reason why is, I think that people try to avoid situations where they have to really understand every single thing in order to just apply a class and make something happen. But what you trade off is that you end up doing that towards Tailwind instead of specific vanilla CSS. And it kind of depends on the project. Because Tailwind does offer something that I think any kind of well-functioning design system or object-oriented design system, you know, if you know what OOCSS was back in the day, Nicole Sullivan invented it long before Tailwind was around. It does offer a system that is clear and also consistent. Like, your designs and those kind of things fall apart when padding is all over the place, when code is unstructured and things like that. And so I think Tailwind does that really nicely. But what can happen in a utility class only world is that it just bloats the HTML or JSX or what have you, the markup, because you end up having to declare all of these things in a row. And it's kind of one of those things where it doesn't really matter if it's a small project. And when it really matters is a bigger project. I've seen code bases that were large and at scale where Tailwind hurt because it ended up being all of these bloated classes that everybody had to parse through. And it's hard to read, right? Like, it's hard to think through, where one, you know, writing it in one concise class probably would have behooved the project. It kind of depends, because it depends on how everything is structured. There are some systems where it might make more sense to have one class that's per the component and more scope to that component. You can do that with Tailwind, of course, but vanilla CSS does force you into a way of thinking and structuring your CSS so that you're, and the way that I'm thinking about vanilla CSS might not be the way that other people are imagining. I am thinking about a replacement system that is kind of like Tailwind, but more tailored to your own code base, right? It's not like I'm advocating for, like, write every single class. I'm advocating for, what does your code base need? And sometimes that means, I think Dan Moll puts this really well when he talks about design systems, that you should be thinking about what your system is doing and what the products are building, and then back up into the design system instead of the other way around. That way you're not bloating the code. You don't have all of these classes that are mismatched and used all over the place. You have more consistency. It's more thoughtful. I do think that there's something to that of saying, like, you know, we're an airline. We're really careful about this, and we need these kind of paddings, and, you know, thinking, being really purposeful about that particular system. I've seen implementations of Tailwind do that really well when they customize it really well and everybody is on the same page about what they're using. I've also seen Tailwind use wrong, where They're just like bloating every line and it's impossible to read. Like it's a kind of a very general question where you can hold it differently per project. Vanilla CSS can mean so many things. What I think the core of it is the outcome. Is your code legible enough that someone can jump into it and understand what it is, what the rules are, what they're refactoring, that it's not like a globby mess? And you can make a globby mess in either system, but as long as you're thoughtful and purposeful, then you can avoid that.
Well, does it stand to reason that as a former contributor to CSS Tricks, that maybe you just love the craft a little bit too?
I actually, you know, it's funny. I contributed a lot to CSS Tricks and people think I do CSS, but I don't. 95% of my articles were not about CSS. They were about JavaScript. So I would punt that back to you and say, I'm actually not a CSS person. I'm actually a JavaScript person.
Yeah. No, and you wrote a managerial article on there too. So, I mean, that's true. I guess I don't want to appear overly naive because I have read some of the articles. Used to be very into that site before some unnamed company kind of buried it. But good for Chris.
I mean, I think like if you're a front end engineer, you care, or even full stack, like you care about the whole thing. Like, you don't care about like one thing. Or if you're a carpenter, you're not like, I only use saws. Like, you know.
But I only use saws. I mean, I'm a carpenter and I only use saws. I just don't build any wood things.
Yeah. You don't use any tools, help myself. Probably, or not that many.
I have a number of tools and I can fix things. So I put my home repair skills up against at least yours. I don't know about anyone, but.
All right. Well, we'll have to build a room one day and see who gets theirs done first.
Can you drink a whole bottle of this and build a room?
Yes. Yeah. Can we do it at your house? Okay. Yeah. I don't want the backlash from my wife. Like, why are you building and doing in our house? Why are you drinking all this while you do it? This is not how her voice sounds. She's going to hear this and yell at me later. Sorry.
We have three children, so we already have forts all over the house.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Pillow forts and that kind of stuff. I have 2, 4, and 7, so their building skills are getting better.
Actual building or fort building?
Fort building.
Okay. You weren't clear.
Yeah. No, they don't have real tools. Robbie.
Well, I was wondering.
She's 4. I can't give her a hammer and nails. Anyway, all right, to another important hot take question. I mean, this one actually is fairly paramount to me. What's the better way to make a burger, sous vide or smash?
Like the answer to that one, all right.
The answer to that, but you can say it out loud.
Now I have validation. we did actually have 17 people over, and we did a cook-off. So for the people who don't know the background, Jason Langsdorf is a horrible person. No, I'm just kidding.
He's all right.
Jason decided to troll me for several years about...
He made a site.
He made a site and was like, contribute to the site or you're a loser, something like that. Threats. This is a person on my staff, by the way.
He's not afraid. So you're not a leader that invokes fear.
That's good. I think maybe, like, looking at this thing, like, was that a fear response? Maybe that was like, we should have brought that up in performance management.
You could have leveraged that. Maybe you did in some ways, and that's how you ended up winning. I don't know.
Well, he wouldn't have like 17 that many other more, which is unfortunate because I definitely would have. But your smash burger sucked. So
maybe it's just his smash burgers. That's hard to say, because I gotta say that's my tried and true method, and I've tried a bunch of different ones. I even have the burger book, that George Motz thing. I've watched the burger show on First We Feast. Like, I'm very interested in burger cooking and culture and all of that kind of stuff. So when I saw that sous vide as a way, I was like, I don't know, you know, the ground and it staying together, and like I was
you should try it.
Questioning it. Yeah, I'm going to have to now.
You know, there's a couple reasons why sous vide is so good. Have you read Simon Nosrat's Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat?
A little bit. I've flipped through it. I wouldn't say read.
She does a really good job of breaking down, like, when you add salt to meat early, it does a lot to tenderize the meat from within. Like, there's a big difference between salting later and salting earlier. And something that sous vide does well is if you add a lot of flavors to that mixture and then you sous vide, you're basically cooking at an even temperature and it's really allowing the flavor profile and all of the protein strands to extract in a certain way that makes it really juicy and tasty. Then if you finish it off with a sear on the grill, then you get a nice combination of the flavors without being overcooked. So it's still kind of packing in that flavor while giving that grill sear so that you get that like nice barbecue kind of flavor on top. That has worked out really well. I think in me and Jason's competition, like there was a bunch of things that went awry that day for both of us. Like, and I was trying to time with him. And so what you're supposed to do is only put it on the grill on either side once, but he thought that he was going to be done in 15 minutes. He was done in an hour. So I kept taking them off the grill, putting them back on. I think like I could have probably gotten an even better sear and the way that the burgers were supposed to be cooked. On his side, he forgot to bring the right spatula. So this is a really funny part of it. He had made this burger belt. That's like a WWF burger belt for the winner. And the loser gets this loser spatula. And he ended up having to use the loser's spatula the day of. So like, at first he's like, I'm not going to use that. And then he was like,
I got to use it.
So, I think on both of our ends, we probably would iterate. But the thing that I win the most in winning that competition is not having to be trolled by him anymore. That's what I was like, we got to pass the baton, the spatula, to another group. So we're going to, there's a new competition happening and neither Jason nor I are in it. It's about mac and cheese. So
growing up in the South, I would accept that challenge also.
Yeah,
I actually like just mostly
eat and not be.
Yeah. Yeah. Be a judge of that. I mostly just use Alton Brown's mac and cheese recipe. Cause it's just, it's amazing.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Oh, so he, you know who Alton Brown is?
I don't know. I've heard his name.
He's been on some of those cooking shows and he's had his own for a while. He has his own site though, and all of his recipes over time are like collected there. So if you just go to altonbrown.com, you'll find it there and it's awesome. Super good. He's a big fan of the Sazerac. I like to make a Sazerac while I cook. It's kind of fun. I mean, you know, a half dozen of them.
I'm going to have to hit you up for these recipes after we...
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'll send you some links or whatever. Yeah, you should get that burger book too and try some of the weird stuff that he has in there. It's just basically goes through like burger history, and that show is really fun on the, it's a YouTube show under the First We Feast umbrella. And the burger show is actually run by a guy out in LA who has like a butcher shop and restaurant, but then like he has George Motz on a bunch of times and some other burger people. So there's some really neat episodes on there.
Cool. Yeah. I don't tell Jason this, but I actually made smash burgers last night. I did the viral smash burger taco thing. I don't
know. Oh,
they're all I've really seen those. Good. Like we were skeptical and then we made them and those are good.
Wasn't it a place out of LA that actually like started those? It was like a pop up in LA, I think. It was doing like smash burger tacos. It was like a, you know, the meld between traditional Mexican food and smash burger culture.
Nice. We did a Greek version where you do beef and tzatziki and...
I would also have that. So maybe you need to share your recipe as well.
Yeah, it's gross and awesome.
Perfect. Win-win. All right. Should we talk about any more tech things, Ravi? I don't know.
Probably. Yeah, we could do a little. I think we should... at least circle back to Angular for a second. We talked about it for a little while, but it's been around a long time. And for maybe people that haven't checked it out in a while, what's changed since, I don't know, version 2 or 3 when it kind of started down this path to version, what, 16, 17? What are we on now? I'm not sure what we're on now. Something high. But like, what is, you know, what's new? What's stayed the same? Like, what's going on in Angular?
So I want to be really honest that because I was in React land, in Vue land, I actually very purposefully did not learn Angular because I got so many questions being in open source spaces and stuff about about React and Vue that I was trying to help people out, that I was very intentionally staying away from Angular because I was like I already get too many questions in my inbox about these and I'm trying to help people. Like, I don't want to, you know, learn literally everything. So I did not participate in Angular until I start joining the team, until I started late. I did hear about all of the things. And I was actually backstage when Brad Green announced Angular 2 and like caused that hubbub and things at our O'Reilly conference. So I knew about it. Like, I heard a lot of people. And I also, when I was learning React from Ryan Florence and Michael Jackson, when we were doing those React training sessions, a lot of Angular developers were there because they were so upset about the shift between AngularJS and Angular 2. In Angular TS or whatever we want to call it, not Angular JS, Angular. A lot has changed because Angular does do these 6-month updates. When I first joined Google, I was a little worried about taking on the Angular team because I was like, how are they going to respond to this like new core team member on their staff? And like, I don't know if they're going to, you know, this is going to be a scary thing or something, but they were actually quite thoughtful and curious and like wanted my perspective on things. So I wrote this doc called Babby's First Angular. And it's like a 13-page doc where I was like, why do you do this? What's this? Like, as I'm like playing with it, because I have come from a React and Vue background, just asked a lot of questions around like, this doesn't make sense to me, or this is really cool. Like, you know, the migration tooling in specific, I was like, oh, we don't have tooling that does this as well in other projects. I would say that since I've looked at the project, what I've seen them change, and so I'm only going to speak to probably 14 through 17 or 13 through 17, I don't know. The reactivity system is quite different now, moving towards signals. If you're familiar with Angular back in the day, they used zone. Zone checked the world. So one might say that it was strong. I don't agree with this, but I'm just trying to present both sides. And it was strong because you didn't have to declare anything. The framework did it for you. The thing that I found very frustrating about that, that's different from the way that React and Vue do things where you're kind of declaring the state that you're trying to look at, was one, debugging was a nightmare. It's giving you all of everything and it's just like a mess and it's very knotted because it's keeping track of state. You're not keeping track of state. There's tons of information about anything that's changed, especially at scale. That I found frustrating. The ability to kind of declare state is also a signal to other developers about what you care about. It's not just, you know, the tracking of it, but it's also the legibility of saying, like, this is a thing that I'm really looking out for, and I need, you know, that's the state that I need you to pay attention to. So there's a little bit of a communication signal to other developers who jump into the project. So in moving to signals, not only is it a really elegant form of reactivity that I think is actually quite good, you know, they listened to my feedback a little, prodding them around things like computed properties. I loved in Vue the ability to cache something based on its dependencies. I found it really useful. That's something that was brought into signals that I didn't see in other implementations. That their ability to kind of think through, well, maybe we can shortcut for some browser APIs and treat those differently. That's really solid.
Pun intended.
So that's a big change. Going from zone to signals is a massive change for the framework. Dealing with change as a developer is a main reason why you use a framework. So that's massive. Control flow is another big one. I would say that Angular has, over the years, because it's withstood so the test of time, has a lot of extra stuff. The team is really thinking through, like, can we get rid of ng modules? Can we get rid of, you know, some of this older systems? And can we clean up some things that were just like not well addressed in earlier versions, like the if-else scenario? I personally appreciate, since I've seen the project, I never told them what to do, but I think that they, I mean, not just with me, but with GDEs, and they reach out to the community, they do surveys, they like do a ton of work to understand where are people really getting stuck. And so they've done a lot of work to address that. I think they're midstream in that, right? If you play with Angular now, you'll see a lot of nice updates. You'll see even more in the coming years.
I think it's a project. I think it's fair to say that it's a project that reacts really well to feedback and iteration and innovation in many different ways. So there's a lot of kudos to that. It's kind of ironic because I can remember a long time ago, one of my complaints about it was around how much it kind of polluted the HTML and using that, you know, as a state flow and all of those things. But then now, lately, I've been talking a lot about regressing back to simpler ideologies, technologies, basic old web frameworks like Django and things, and Rails, maybe Rails is fine too. Maybe it's all fine. And then things like HTMX and Astro Project and all these other things somewhat polluting the HTML for interactivity, but then just looking at starting with that base thing. So I'm a big hypocrite many years later, is really my point.
I don't think that's hypocritical at all. That's like, I think that's the reason why so many senior devs go towards this kind of it depends way of thinking, because we see so many different implementations over time, and then the nuance strikes us. I think when you're younger, you would love to believe in this like good and evil and bad and good, and there's one true way. And over time, you realize like, it's not actually the truth. And there are things that get in your way, for sure. There's definitely bad things, for sure. But there's also, on good ends of spectrums, there are trade-offs for everything. The more you see different implementations, different programming languages, different frameworks, the more you understand, like, I might get this, but I'm also trading off that. Directives versus TSX, like, do you need dynamicism? Or would you rather something stay within some sort of boundaries? These are things that, you know, as long as you can compose a component, you could battle back and forth forever. Some of it would end up being preference or nuance for those trade-offs.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that you sort of get more open-minded, I guess, over time. I think that's like kind of part of it. Kind of reminds me, for some reason, talking about some of your career and all of that, there's like a popular Charity Majors article. It wasn't even that long ago, I don't think, talking about the pendulum of management to contributor and sort of like kind of keeping that swing ongoing throughout your career.
It's one of my favorite articles, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think it's amazing. I think it's great. It's like it changes a paradigm of thinking out of folks need to constantly be leveling up, quote unquote, whatever that means, right? Like by title and salary or whatever, in perpetuity to have success necessarily and to be a part of successful companies. And I think that's a giant misnomer. So anyway, my question would be like, is that something you see for yourself in your career?
Oh yeah. I think actually before she wrote that article, I was wondering like, am I broken for doing both? Because I have done IC work and I was very committed to only being an IC. I didn't want to be a manager for a really long time. I know I've written a book about management, but I talk about it in the book. Like, I really didn't want to be a manager, and all of a sudden I was kind of thrown laterally into management, and I didn't have any tools for that, because you can be a really good developer and then it's like all of a sudden you're a baker and you're like, but what? It's totally a different skill set in some ways, not always, but some ways. I love that article because it spoke to the thing that I feel. I love to code and I will always code on the side. If I retire someday, I'm coding. Like, retiring to code. The thing that I found frustrating about only coding for a long time, especially as I got higher as a principal and things, was if I wasn't aligned to the strategy that my code was making, you know, enabling, that felt demoralizing to me. Like, why am I building all this stuff and I don't even think that it's being used properly? I don't even think that the leadership is doing the right thing here. And then in order to fix that, you end up more in these kind of strategic management positions. So I kind of go where I think I'm more strategically placed. That could be developing and coding. That could also be providing strategy to a broad team for directives. And I think it's valuable to see both tracks, because I'll be very honest that I didn't have empathy for managers until I was one. My husband was a VP of engineering while I was a principal IC. And he still makes fun of me because there was one time where I got done with work and I was like, I have to do hard work all day, like debugging and fixing things, and you get to sit in meetings.
Get to. You feel a bit differently about that.
I think I have a different perspective now, and I think it's actually kind of healthy to understand how hard the other job is, because there are a lot of days where I now where I'm going like, both are hard. I'm not saying like I see work isn't hard. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying, are hard.
I bet sometimes you're in particular meetings and you're like, gosh, I wish it was just heads down making something.
Absolutely. Like I do miss flow state. I think that's why I still code on the side or do these projects on the side, because you don't get a lot of flow state as a manager.
No. 3 hours, 4 hours of meetings doesn't put you into, doesn't give you any endorphins.
3 hours of meetings a day.
Yeah, I was going to say, why so few hours, Chuck?
I was assuming Google was more efficient, but it is a big company. So I think what it is that you are becoming very well poised to still start that company.
Well, you know, I think that there's probably someday that I want to start a company of my own. I really enjoy this job, maybe even more than I expected to. I think it took a second to get into it because Google's culture is different. Google's tech stack is different. Like there's a lot that is quite different from the outside world. And so it took an adjustment period. But man, these are like really thoughtful, hardworking teams who are really so smart. And I know everybody says, like, I'm humbled to work with my team. I really mean it. I'm really humbled to work with the people that I do. I learned so much from them, and I just love the things that we work on together. So,
well, they're giving you a lot of fodder for your follow-up book too. So there's that.
Why I'm a fan of my staff.
Yeah, there you go. You know, how to become a fan of your employees or something of that nature. That could be a good one.
So on the other side, if you weren't in tech, what career would you choose? And this could be, you don't have to have this skill. It can be like, what do you think would be the most fun career if you could just miraculously get a skill or whatever?
Well, that's a good one. Miraculously getting a skill, like I would want to be a superhero, right? Because that would be super fun. Sometimes you watch Spider-Man movies and it's like, wow, if I could just, and you know, like anything. I don't want to do superhero stuff, but I don't think that's in the cards for me because I'm quite small and I have no reflexes and I'm not good at sports, so probably not. If I wasn't in tech, I do love problem solving. So anything that engages that part of the brain of problem solving would be fantastic. I like outcomes and problem solving. So architecture or like just, you know, I like building things for other people. In former lives, I was a professor. I taught people. I do like teaching. That's another kind of outcome. It's more, you know, helping other people see the value in things or understand things.
Yeah, that seem like pretty good ones. Not as good as superhero, but you could be a superhero teacher, you know, with an actual living salary. That would be your superpower. Can I be a teacher and survive on this?
What would you do?
Whatever made me Robbie's boss, that's what I would do. I just want to be in charge of him, telling him what to do and him not being able to complain about it. I think I would have like interests much like my like 7-year-old self or something, like car racing, something I think is I don't know, I've dabbled into a couple of times in life and like would be very interested in. I do enjoy speed. I don't like dying, but I could see where
you've tried it before and
build up into
that. You
didn't
like it much?
I did autocross for a little bit and, you know, yeah, things like that. But so I think that, or there was a time in like my early 30s, I was like, I really love soccer and like, you know, obsessively like watch it and everything else, was never like good enough to have any kind of career there. And didn't really think about it until like my early 30s that like being a referee is a way to like stay close to the game. It's actually a pretty decent career, makes a decent living. You get travel. There's all those aspects that I actually like about it. I can be close to the game. I get to travel a lot, stay fit, you know, those kinds of things. So, but there are some age limits. There's, you know, so basically starting late in life is pretty hard. But I think, yeah, being a football, European football referee.
Yeah, I would maybe continue towards a similar theme, except American football. Like, I always like playing football. Like, I was never on a real team, but just playing with friends and stuff. That, or like, I did a lot of music growing up. I was in bands and stuff. So, like, a touring musician of some kind would be fun. But, yeah, I was never good enough at any of that stuff to make money doing it. So, that would be a... Oh, I miraculously like lucked out kind of thing. But yeah, that would be.
You did
really
pivot pretty early in life, though, didn't you? Like, have a band until you were like 18 or something. Pretty.
Oh, I was in bands until most of the way through college, I think. So like 20 or so, I stopped.
We have to find your music online somewhere.
Oh, I can send it to you. It's not really online, I don't think, but I'm not sure why. I should throw it on SoundCloud or something.
Yeah, I want to hear it too.
Okay. He has some Christmas songs.
I do have, yeah.
And you've done more recent Christmas songs,
Christmas
too.
Christmas songs, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You should share and publish those.
Well, Chuck will be tweeting that out later, I guess.
mm-hmm. Yeah, I got to find it because I know you like send some to us. It was good. Yeah. Or maybe like my wife is also Sarah with an H, and I know that matters. So I say with an H.
Yeah, one of those things you only know if you know a Sarah.
Exactly, yes. And I don't know if she found it or you sent it to her, maybe.
Yeah, like I posted it on Facebook. But... Once a year, I record a Christmas song for my mom and I post it on Facebook. That's the only time I post on Facebook. Like, that's all I do.
Yeah. I got to hear these now. Like, that's great.
Yes. So my action items are to send you a link to the burger show, although you could probably find that. The Alton Brown recipes. So these are more like reminders. And, a Robbie song. Okay. We can do this. Do you prefer formally Twitter or email?
Either works. I'm on Twitter a bit less because I have less time. email is
That's fair.
Probably easier.
Sounds good. Yeah. We don't have to publish your email here.
Don't give out your email unless you want.
Yeah. If you want me to like spread the love, which I'm happy to do.
I don't know that going out to the wider audience.
I think he's like, please don't know, but kind of if you want to.
A couple of them, I think, are okay, and a couple of them are kind of.
I'm hearing Twitter. That's what I'm hearing from you. It's like, yeah, we got to spread the word here.
Yeah, like share it, and if it does well, then yes.
Then I meant that. If it doesn't, I'll take them down.
Yeah, and he can be like, no, don't do this. I didn't want that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you're hesitant.
Yeah. Anyway, we are over time here. Is there anything you want to plug or mention before we end?
How about your book that we didn't talk about?
I really appreciate you having me. This has been really fun. And like this ability to like drink this wonderful whiskey with you, even though we're remote, is so wonderful. I wrote a book. I should. Yeah, you can read my book if you want. it was cathartic to write because I felt like when I started managing, I really didn't have anybody to help me. And I had to learn a lot of stuff by learning on people that was hard on them, I think. And so I tried to write stuff down so that other people had some resources. So if you want to read it, great. If you don't, totally good. I would also plug She Code Africa. Half of the book proceeds go to She Code Africa, but you can also just donate to them directly. She Code Africa is run by a wonderful woman named Ada, who is basically empowering a lot of women in tech in Africa. She gives them laptops, she creates courses, she creates community conferences, things like that, which allows for people to have upward mobility, allows for people to create generational wealth, and is just a really cool project. There's a lot of, they also work on job placement for people, so if you're interested in that, you should check her out. She's Colocodes on Twitter. I'll give you that handle. And also She Code Africa is a handle in and of itself.
Cool. Awesome.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you liked it, please subscribe. Leave us some ratings and reviews. We appreciate it, and we will catch you next time.